hopkinsforthearts.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, coming up, an island community here on Florida's west coast is in danger of sinking as sea levels rise. We'll hear about what some environmentalists are saying about the future of Cedar Key in a moment. Later, we'll talk with one of America's preeminent historians about his new biography of President Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt had the political skills to pass major legislation in his time in office. We'll hear how he did it in a moment. First, one listener comment about yesterday's show, on which we talked about how to prevent gun massacres like the one that happened to churchgoers Sunday in Texas. Here's what one listener had to say.
It seems to me that if the majority of NRA members would demand that the NRA get out of politics and go back to gun safety and gun education and training, that they could be taken a whole lot more seriously. If they were serious, they would en masse quit the weapons manufacturing lobbyist group known as the NRA and form a new gun safety and training organization. Saying they support gun safety while paying membership dues to the NRA to be used to buy politicians in state houses all across the United States is a very weak and disingenuous argument. Thank you.
Well, there was a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. This weekend in Cedar Key, here on Florida's west coast, near the Citrus County, Levy County line, there's going to be a conference on climate change and a celebration of John Muir's 150th anniversary trek through Florida. We're going to find out about that in just a moment. But we're joined now by Paul Thibeault, who is with the Sierra Club, and he's up in Cedar Key right now. And Paul, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be with you, Rob.
So for folks who haven't been to Cedar Key, how would you describe where it is?
Well, from the I-75, you take 24, and that's 50 miles to Cedar Key, to going west. And that takes you to the coast.
Yeah, it's north of Inverness. And
yes.
Cedar Key is an island up there on the Nature Coast.
And double island.
And it's a what?
Several islands.
Several islands, I'm sorry. And it got pretty hard hit by the recent hurricanes, right?
Yes, in August 2016, early September, Irmine really, really whacked the place. And that brings us to the issue of climate change. And during the early 2016, the University of Florida research team under Dr. Catherine Franks had done a study in Cedar Key. And one of the amazing things they did a video of 2nd Street, which is the main street for Cedar Key. And on that video, they superimposed the water rise based on a storm surge and a hurricane. So that was in May. They showed that video to the citizens of Cedar Key. And in the late September when Hermine hit, that was exactly the level of the water that rose into Cedar Key. So science does tell the story truthfully sometimes.
And was the whole island covered by water during Hermine?
No, not at all. But some parts of it were quite damaged. I came in a few days after that on my first trip here, and a lot of material, refrigerators, mattresses, stoves and everything were piled along the side of the street to be tossed away.
Now,
so it really hit them.
Now, I've been to Cedar Key once. It's a great vacation town, lots of small shops and nice little restaurants. Are folks there beginning to think that they should leave the island?
No. There are two parts to the climate change issue. Some academicians are talking about the idea of in identifying areas and retreat from those areas. Others talk about the term adaptation. In other words, you try to adapt to the issues that you're confronted with, sea level rise, flooding, infiltration of fresh water, and so forth. And the Cedar Key, this is a tremendous community. It is kind of unbelievable when you get here and talk to the people. It has a very supportive infrastructure between the people themselves. And so they have come to the idea of adaptation over a period of time, as long as they can support themselves in it. And so they've worked very hard to meet the issues of climate change. They had to change their economic process here. Net fishing was banned in the 90s, so they turned to clamming and oystering. And here they're now famous for their Cedar Key clams. And, of course, clams require a very pure water. So they've worked on their septic systems and drainage water and all of that to begin to protect that economic interest. So they're leaders in, you know, climate change and that effect.
So this Friday, there's going to be beginning a two-day conference on climate change. What's going to go on at the conference there?
Well, climate change, is the morning period from 9 to noon before lunch will be the University of Florida research team that did the research on Cedar Key and Levy County and the effects of climate change and sea level rise. So they have three videos they will show, the one I mentioned to you, and then two other videos showing over a period of time projected off into, you know, the 2020s, 2030s, 2050s, what the water sea level rise will do to impact the city of Cedar Key.
What's the projection? What's the projection say?
Well, the picture looks pretty bad for the downtown. You know, Cedar Key, as you remember being here, there is a very hilly section, about 35 to 40-something feet high. So there is land that can be occupied, but, you know, it will impact Route 24 that comes in, and it will impact the low-lying historical area of Cedar Key. But that's often the distance and issue they're trying to deal with issues. They lost their city hall, access to their city hall and their city library. They have to raise those two buildings to be in conformity to new sea level issues.
So those are unusable right now?
Right now they're not being used.
Wow. I'm sorry, you interrupted. So what else is going to go on this weekend?
Well, that and then the afternoon, as we talk about University of Florida in the morning, in the afternoon, the community people will speak to their efforts at adaptation and what they're confronted with now, the issues they're confronted with. And that's an interesting thing. How does a local community the size of Cedar Key deal with this issue? And, you know, you've got problems with Tampa, you've got problems with Key West, you've got problems with Miami, you've got problems with Jacksonville. This is a small community, and how are they going to deal with the issues? And, you know, they've been at this for quite a while. This is not something new to them. And when you think of what the other infrastructure problems are in those larger areas, it's going to be a significant problem. Well, it's just kind of a textbook introduction.
Well, I guess it's Paul Thibault, who is with the executive committee and the conservation chair of the Tampa Bay Sierra Club. He's up in Cedar Key right now for a two-day conference that begins on Friday. It's called the Cedar Key Climate Change Conference. Cedar Key is a tiny coastal island off Florida's Big Bend, and it's got a lot of history to it. Railroad and trade was one of its chief industries way back in the 1800s. It's one of the most threatened Florida coastal islands here in Florida. Is Cedar Key any different than Miami Beach or St. Pete Beach? Is it more threatened?
I can't answer that, but I would think that the measures that they're taking in Miami are certainly far more expensive than what Cedar Key is able to undertake.
You know, yeah, because they just passed a...
They're changing their pumping system and all of that.
Yeah, they just passed a $600 million bond issue yesterday to help with the climate change issues of Miami Beach.
Yeah, the costs on this are going to be incredible. And that's why, again, to go back to the issue of whether you retreat or adapt, some of those people that talk about retreat, the cost to do the adaptation in some of those populated areas, New York, Jacksonville, Norfolk, and Tampa, you're talking about trillions of dollars, and they predict the impact on our economy would be significant. You know, healthcare and education and all of that would suffer if you get into the idea of building dikes and pumps and raising roads and all of that. So we have to make some critical decisions in the distant, near and distant future.
Well, you've got local officials from Cedar Key who are talking. You've got academics from the University of Florida. You've got Frank Jackalone from the Sierra Club. You've got Dr. Yogi Goswami, who is one of the top experts in the country. He's at USF in Tampa, but one of the top experts in the country on solar energy. So if people want to find out more about the conference this weekend, how can they find out more?
You go to www.florida.sierraclub.org. All one word, .org.
Now, one of the... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And they have we have all the information there about the programs for both days. And if you want to sign up to come and attend, then you could sign up. And we're asking a fee for both days.
Okay. Now, one of the parts of the conference this weekend is a tribute by the Sierra Club to Sierra Club founder John Muir. And it's the 150th anniversary of his travel to Florida. John Muir, the founder of the Sierra Club. Well, tell us about what John Muir did when he was in Florida.
Well, John Muir walked 1,000 miles from Indianapolis to Cedar Key. And the purpose of his trip was to broaden his... He's a botanist. And he had left a job in a factory because he got injured in his eye. So it was one of those significant changes in his life. Something he always wanted to do was be a botanist, but he was trying to make a living in a mill. He was kind of a mechanical genius for his time. And when he got hit in the eye, he didn't want to do that anymore. He was going to be a botanist. So then he started to think, what do I want to do? He wanted to go to Brazil because he had read books on the tropical flowers of Brazil and it really intrigued him. So he started this 1,000-mile walk to start his way to Brazil and got to Cedar Key, having come through Savannah, Fernandina, and walked what you could almost walk the drive today, A1A to 301 to 24 and down to Cedar Key. And that pretty much would travel the route that he walked went on a railroad track.
Now this is before there are any medicines or anything, and there were lots of mosquitoes here. We didn't have mosquito control back then, 150 years ago. Did he get sick?
Yeah, very much so. And we say, we say that he got sick by sleeping in a cemetery in Savannah waiting for money to come from his brother by telegraph. And so the two-week intubation period, it would have worked out quite right by the time he got ill in Cedar Key. So about 3 days after arriving in Cedar Key, he became quite ill, fatigued, sweating. And then at one point, he came into Cedar Key, the town, because he was working in the sawmill out on what is now known as Rye Key, then Rye Key. That's about a mile and a half or more from Cedar Key itself. And he got quite ill there and kind of slipped into a coma or unconsciousness. And had to be taken from there by the owner to their residence on Hudson Hill, which the Hudson family. And there he was brought back to health. But in the meantime, the treatment for malaria, of course, was quinine. And he was also being given calomel, which is mercury chloride, in heavy doses, both of them. So the after effects of that were a long recovery. It took him several months to recover from this. And even then, when he traveled from Cedar Key to Cuba, he was still not well. And he ended up with what was called dropsy in its day, which is edema. So his legs were swollen, like he said, like fence posts. So here's a guy that just walked 1,000 miles, 29 years old, in perfect health. This is the first time he's been ill. You can imagine the impact on him, the significance of this, how close he came to being dead if he had not been taken in by the Hodgson family. Sarah and Richard Hodgson took care of him over that period of time and saved his life.
Amazing, amazing.
Alone in a coma, a guy from away with a strange Scottish accent, who's going to do anything with him, you know?
And then he goes on later to actually found the Sierra Club after the travels to Florida and Cuba.
Yes, he did. He left here in 1868, and they founded the Sierra Club in 1892. It's one of the oldest and largest environmental organization in the country.
Fascinating.
We have almost a million members, and in Florida we have nearly 40,000 members.
Is there evidence there in Cedar Key that John Muir was there? Anything left behind or any?
You're trying to trick me into giving me the answer.
Okay, I want people to be surprised then. Okay.
No, that's okay. I'll just give you an outline of what it is. When John Muir was here and he was ill and he sat up on Hodgson Hill outside the Hodgson residence, he drew a sketch of what was he called Lime Key, and it's taken us some time to identify that Lime Key changed its name to Jim Green Lime Key, and so we've identified it, and there will be talks about that, comparing that to the sketch. There are some differences in the key or island based on the fact that there were shell middens out there, and those shell middens were used to create the airport at Cedar Key. The other fact that we're working with is the locating the Hodgson property from records of 1868 and 1891, and we have found through the efforts of a genius person with knowing chains and links and compass directions, Kent Bailey, who is the chair of Tampa Bay Sierra Club, and so he was able to chart for us what that property would look like based on that information, starting from a tree that we've identified as probably the tree that was used as the marker tree to begin the survey of the property.
And it still exists 150 years later.
Yeah, it was measured at 61 inches in 1868, and it is 141 inches now.
That's great. That's great. Well, Paul, thank you so much for coming on WMNF. The event is this weekend. It's at Cedar Key. It's called the Cedar Key Climate Change Conference. It begins on Friday, and then on Saturday there will be a tribute to Sierra Club founder John Muir, who 150 years ago traveled to Florida, was on Cedar Key. So, Paul, if people want to find out more, what's the best way to find out more?
Go to our website. The Sierra Club website is www.florida.sierraclub.org.
All right. Well, Paul Tebow, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
Thank you very much, Rob. Thanks for having me.
All right. Great to have you here.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, and Cedar Key, the tiny coastal island off Florida's Big Bend, is one of the most threatened Florida coastal islands in the face of climate change and sea level rise. So we all got to pay attention to what's going on there. Well, I'm Rob Lori. This is Radioactivity. Thanks a lot for tuning in. One of the most successful presidents of all time was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In a period of just 100 days, he passed some amazing legislation. He was elected four times to the presidency before there was a limit on how many times you could run for president. Among his New Deal reforms, Social Security, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, unemployment insurance, the National Labor Relations Board, the legitimization of labor unions, rural electrification, many dams that create electricity and other conservation projects, and the Fair Labor Standards Act. Roosevelt was married to Eleanor Roosevelt, and together they made quite a team. There's a new book that looks at the political life of Franklin D. Roosevelt. It was written by our next guest, Robert Dalek. Dalek is one of the country's most prominent historians. He's written about several presidents, including John F. Kennedy. He's just out with this new book about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and I spoke with him earlier today. Robert Dalek, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Great to be with you.
Let me ask you, at the end of your book, you say that President Franklin Roosevelt is perhaps the greatest post-president that we've ever had. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the sense that he continues to have, I think, an extraordinary hold on the public's imagination. You know, there are three presidents who are consistently seen as great: George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt. You see, now there are others who are seen as near great, like Theodore Roosevelt. People continue to greatly admire Ronald Reagan, and there's a sense that Roosevelt has a permanent place in the icon of great presidents, and that he did so much to change the country, to lead it through such turbulent, difficult times.
Part of his legacy is that he created the welfare state that, yep, despite efforts to dismantle it by some presidents, President Reagan and certainly President Trump, that welfare state survives.
Absolutely, because, you know, it's a permanent part of our political, social landscape. Indeed, you know, Roosevelt didn't lead the country out of the Depression. In 1940, after he had been in office for over 7 years, and he was running for a third term, there was still something like 10 million people who were unemployed. There had been as many as 25% of the workforce that was without employment when Roosevelt came into office. So it had been reduced, but it was by no means the end of the Depression. It was an industrial mobilization that did that in 39 and 40. But Roosevelt did something more important. He humanized the American industrial system with this welfare state. They put into place Social Security, the wages and hours law, minimum wage, maximum hours, FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Remember, at the start of the Roosevelt presidency, the banks were collapsing. People were losing their life savings, and they ended that. They guaranteed that people weren't going to lose their farms and weren't going to lose their homes, and it was enormously popular at the time because people had such a sense of desperation, and he lifted their spirits. Indeed, the great columnist Walter Lippmann, after Roosevelt gave the first fireside chat about the banking crisis, the mood in the country changed overnight. And Lippmann said there was no change in the economy. What had changed was Roosevelt's words, and he had mobilized the English language, so to speak, in support of hope in the country. And remember also, he was a man who was paralyzed from the waist down. And people thought, they knew he had had polio, but they thought he had largely recovered from his disability. And so there was the sense that he was the perfect man to lead the country at this time, because if he could recover personally from his physical disability, he could lead the country to recover from its economic collapse, downturn. And so there was a sense of him as the right man in the right place at the right time. And he had a great sense of public mood. And, you know, polling didn't begin until 1935, but he had a feel for the public that is something you can't teach someone. It's instinctual.
We're talking with Robert Dalek about his new book, Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. You spend a lot of time talking about President Roosevelt and his polio, and the more than a year that he spent at home recuperating after he was first diagnosed.
Yes.
What did he do? He was able to pretend and put on this this front that belied his paralysis. What did he do to kind of hide his paralysis?
Well, first of all, there are no surviving photographs of him with his disability that survived from his presidency. This was out of bounds. And you see, in those days, the press was much more cooperative, you see. And also, he learned to walk with, as he put it later, 10 pounds of steel around each of his lower limbs. The only time he ever made public reference to his disability was after he came back from the Yalta Conference in 1945, and on March 1, he gave a speech to a joint session of the Congress, and he said, "I know you will forgive me for sitting down, for I carry 10 pounds of steel around each of my lower limbs." and I've just returned from a journey of 10,000 miles, you see. It's the only time he ever made public reference to his disability. And he would walk with a cane and with holding on to the arm of his son or some aide, you see. And he gave the impression that he was largely recovered, but in fact he never had mobility in his legs anymore, or movement, feeling, and then of course on top of that his health was very precarious. Beginning in 1940, it's clear that he had the beginnings of congestive heart failure, and he had the terrible hypertension. His blood pressure readings, which we have, were off the chart, and he struggled with his health.
And that's one of the points of your book, is that I think you make the point that he was diagnosed, or some around him recognized that he had this these terrible health problems, and then even then he decided to run for re-election for a fourth term in 1944.
Yep, exactly. You know, he knew that if the war were over at that point, the war, of course, ended in 45 in the following year, but in 44, he knew that if the war were over, what the polls showed him and what his instinctual understanding told him was that he wouldn't win a fourth term. But with the war still going on, people wanted him to remain in office, and he understood that. He also spoke about the possibility that if he were elected to a fourth term, that he would only serve for maybe a year. Then he would resign, and he wanted to be the head of some kind of international peace organization, and he'd leave the presidency to the vice president, who was Harry Truman. And so he knew that there were limits to what he could do. But his health was so precarious that when he was at the Yalta Conference in February 45, Winston Churchill's physician, Lord Moran, wrote in his diary, "The president will be dead in 3 months' time. He has hardening of the arteries of the brain." And he called it right on the mark.
Mm. We're talking with Robert Dalek. The book is Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life. Roosevelt was a patrician. He had ties to the political family, the Roosevelt family, the Theodore Roosevelt family. But he came from a patrician background. How did he end up coming into progressive politics? Was he a progressive from the start, or was there a point in his life that he became progressive?
Well, his father was a Democrat and was a Grover Cleveland Democrat, which was a pretty conservative Democrat. Cleveland was from New York. The Roosevelt family was from Hyde Park, Dutchess County, New York. And but for FDR himself, I think the polio had a huge impact on his outlook, on his disposition. He understood what personal suffering could mean. And when the Depression set in and people were in such miserable shape, and he was governor of New York at the time, and he threw himself into supportive programs, public programs, that could alleviate this suffering. Now, also, he identified with his distant cousin, Theodore Roosevelt, who, of course, had been a progressive Republican, and FDR liked the idea of using authority, using power to solve problems, solve public problems, and deal with excessive concentrations of wealth and power, which is what the progressive program was about. So he had a certain pressures on him or impulses going back to Theodore Roosevelt, and he was in, FDR was in the Woodrow Wilson administration as the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and so there was a history there of his being committed to that kind of activity or action, and also the Great Depression, of course, influenced, shaped what he did.
He had polio, and when he did, one of the things that he did shortly after was to buy a resort in Warm Springs, Georgia, that, as legend had it, it was a cure for polio. That didn't work out so well, but one of the things that happened at that point was that he got a car that he was able to drive, even though he was paralyzed, but he could drive the car using his arms. That car enabled him to get in touch with average folks. How so?
Well, because he wanted to be out there on the hustings, so to speak. When he first became governor of New York, won the election in 1928 to be governor of New York, he would travel about the state. And one of the ways he'd travel would be on riverboats. That he, first of all, he loved water. He loved ship travel. And he would go into these remote towns in upstate New York and would travel by riverboat. And it was his way of getting in touch with people who had never met a governor before, had never been in touch with a high public official, you see. And so that resonated through the electorate in the state of New York and gave the feeling that this was a man who cared about people. And, you know, and as I say so often, people responded to that. And they said, I miss the way your husband used to speak to me about my government, someone told Eleanor Roosevelt. You see, people said, the president knows me. I don't know him, but he knows me. And there was a feeling that he was connected to them.
And in Georgia, he used this car to drive around and meet the folks in the rural communities there in the west central part of Georgia.
Yep, it was part of his political outlook that the South was important to him. And indeed, one of the drawbacks, it's been pointed out, of his administration was his limited contact with and support of civil rights and of African Americans. And he was so wedded to the Southern conservative chairman of the various House and Senate committees, and they were a power in the Congress, and if he were going to get legislation passed, he needed to court these Southern segregationists. However, what's so ironic is that despite his failure to support anti-lynching legislation or back civil rights laws, by the end of his presidency, part of that New Deal political coalition was the African-American community in America. Because the saying was, turn Lincoln's face to the wall, that is, remove yourself from the Republican Party. It's the Democrats, if not directly, at least indirectly, are going to give us benefits of government largesse.
He did take some baby steps towards civil rights. In the 40s, he spoke in favor of getting African-Americans involved in the military.
Absolutely, and in fact, Eleanor Roosevelt was a driving force in this, and there was an air unit of African-American pilots trained in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and Eleanor Roosevelt prodded the military and prodded Franklin to get that unit into action, which is what they wanted to have. And they made an extraordinary record in combat, shooting down lots of German planes and winning all sorts of medals, commendations. And the same was true of Japanese Americans, who, of course, had been incarcerated by the Roosevelt administration in 1942 at the start of the war in the Pacific. And by 1943, they allowed draft-age Japanese Americans to form themselves into a military unit, and they fought brilliantly in Italy up the boot and won more commendations and medals and acclaim than almost any other unit in the American Army during all of World War II.
Well, I want to go back to the start of his administration, his presidential administration in 1932, because these questions of race, questions of immigration, questions of what to do about the economy, because this is the height of the Depression in 1932, and questions about isolationism, all those questions, economy, isolationism, race, immigration, those are the same kind of questions we're dealing with today. Could you set the scene for us when it comes to the economy, isolationism, and immigration?
Yeah. Well, the economy, of course, was in 32 in miserable shape, 25% unemployment, a country that was, the prices had collapsed. There was a sense that maybe what we needed was to have a state-controlled economy the way they had in the Soviet Union, you see. Or maybe what we needed was a dictator like Italy had in Mussolini or Adolf Hitler in Germany. And there was just the sense that maybe American free enterprise was at the end of its tether. As far as immigration went, nobody wanted more immigrants to come into the country. What are we going to do with them? There's so much unemployment, they're just going to add to the welfare rolls and get on some kind of dole. And, of course, this would make for a terrible difficulty with allowing Jewish migration to the United States from Nazi Germany, where Jews, of course, were being persecuted. And it's something, it's a bit of a cloud that hangs over the Roosevelt administration to this day, that they really did not battle hard enough to change those immigration laws. But, of course, there was a lot of anti-Semitism at the time, and the Depression was such a great political force in this country that nobody wanted to, not many people wanted to allow foreigners free access to the United States.
Well, and one of the huge lessons I think that Americans took from World War One is that there was a growing feeling in the country after the war. There was during the war, but even after the war, that the war was fought for the bankers and for the military weapons companies, and there was a there was a sense of pacifism and isolationism beginning at the end of World War One from 1918 on, right up until 1932.
Absolutely, and beyond 32, because during in 35 and 36, 37, there were the neutrality laws that were passed, which essentially were laws to keep the United States out of World War One. Under those neutrality laws, we could not sell munitions to any belligerent. We could not make loans to a belligerent. Americans could not travel on ships going into war zones. American ships couldn't go in there so that they would be exposed to submarine attacks, which had been so powerful in drawing us into the First World War. And the consequence was that Roosevelt had to battle against this isolationism. And in 1939, as World War II was about to begin, Roosevelt wanted to change the neutrality law to something called cash and carry, which meant that if we sold munitions to a belligerent, they had to pay cash and they had to carry it away in their own ships, you see. And that failed until the war actually broke out in September, and then in November they got a revised neutrality law to cash and carry. And later, of course, when the British couldn't pay for munitions anymore, Roosevelt engineered the passage of what was known as Lend-Lease, that we were going to lend and lease materiel to the British, and then subsequently, of course, to the Russians. That law passed in March of 41, and the Russians were dragged into the war in June 22nd, 41, when the Nazis attacked them. So Roosevelt had a tremendous uphill battle to overcome this isolationism, and really offered a kind of brilliant leadership, step by step. The Destroy Bases deal in September 1940, when he provided Churchill with 50 overage destroyers in return for 99-year leases on bases in the Caribbean and the Atlantic on what were known as the approaches to the eastern seaboard of the United States. And so he was very careful about not going beyond what public opinion would allow in dealing with these this international crisis. Of course, Pearl Harbor changed everything. It made for the collapse of isolationism, essentially, because the United States then got into the war with all its energy and might.
We're talking with historian Robert Dalek about his new book, Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Roosevelt's first 100 days in office, legendary, after he was elected in 1932, got a lot done. Not just presidential proclamations, but actual laws passed in the first 100 days. What were among the significant things that he got passed through Congress?
Well, he got 15 major pieces of legislation in 100 days, and that's why every administration at the outset, people talk about the 100 days, and of course it's artificial at this point, but it means a great deal in terms of the Roosevelt experience. Roosevelt got passed the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, so that they brought all sorts of young unemployed men into the forests and woods of the country to do conservation and make some money which they could send back to their families. They passed the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, FERA, which gave help to those who were desperate and afraid of starving, you see. They set up the PWA, the Public Works Administration, so that they did road building and built post offices and all sorts of public buildings, airports, you see, so that people could find work and could do something productive, constructive, and get a weekly or monthly check from the government to sustain themselves. Indeed, Ronald Reagan's father worked for the Public Works Administration. He had been a shoe salesman and, of course, was unemployed, and it gave him some money to sustain his family. There was a federal homeowner's loan corporation set up to help people hang on to their homes, including farmers, so that they wouldn't lose their farms. And it went on from there, you see, to passing in 1935 Social Security and a wages and hours law, so that there was minimum wages and maximum hours. So it humanized the American industrial system. It created a safety net. It created a sense of safety from the vagaries of the economy.
He saved capitalism. You mentioned before that there were people pulling at him from all sides. Some wanted the U.S. to go in the direction of a dictatorship like Mussolini or Hitler. Some wanted to stick with the kind of Hoover idea, that is, laissez-faire. Others thought that even in these steps toward a welfare state, Roosevelt should have gone farther. He should have nationalized more. He did create the Tennessee Valley Authority and had rural electrification, but he didn't really go as far as some people to his left wanted him to go.
True. But you see, he was in that sense a moderate. He was someone who did not want to put across things that would later bring about such sharp recriminations that it would jeopardize the other parts of the New Deal. You mentioned TVA. It was a pioneering experiment, and he turned an area of the Upper South from general poverty to economic prosperity, and it became a much more prosperous and attractive place for people to live. But he was judicious in what he was doing. And as it was, as I said, 15 major bills, it was a staggering achievement, especially when you set it alongside of what would come subsequently. People struggle, presidents struggle to get legislation, major legislation passed. And you see it with this current administration. And Roosevelt did 15 significant bills in 100 days.
I want to ask you about his how he was able to convince people. You mentioned before the fireside chats and that people felt like the president was really talking to them. In your book, you write about his kind of unfailing optimism. No matter how he was feeling, he was always optimistic. How was he able, though, to convince Republicans and Democrats to support the kinds of programs, this new welfare state that hadn't existed before? How was he able to convince them?
Well, you know, when he came to the Democratic Convention in 1932 to accept the nomination, he said, "We must be prophets of a new order." And people accepted that, that the country had reached such a low in its economy and in its confidence in the ability of free enterprise to produce and sustain prosperity for the majority of Americans, that they were ready for experiment. They were ready for something fresh, something new, something different. And that's what he did. He gave them the sense that they were on a what John Kennedy later called the new frontier, you see. And it was a kind of new frontier in American economic life and providing a role for government that it had never played before. And it has played ever since, because we have this safety net that even when Ronald Reagan came in, he was not going to dismantle the safety net. What politician in this country nowadays would argue for the repeal of Social Security or for Medicare, you see? It would be political suicide, because these are programs that are extremely popular and are part of the national social fabric, and people believe in them, and they see it as a part of a humane social system.
In the few minutes that we've got left, I want to ask about the women in his life, because there are four women in his life that he relied on as a sounding board, three of whom there's some question about whether or not he was having affairs with. But I want to start with Eleanor. Eleanor was sort of his conscience. I don't know if you would say that, but
I would.
And they had some tension, though. There's a joke you tell in the book where Eleanor has just gone to the doctor, and Franklin says to her, "What did your doctor say about?" Could you tell that joke?
Absolutely. It's my favorite joke in the book. Ben Cohen told the story. Cohen was part of the Brain Trust and was on Roosevelt's staff. He was a brilliant lawyer. And he came in the Oval Office one morning, and Roosevelt was chuckling. And Cohen said to him, "Would you mind sharing the joke with me, Mr. President?" And Roosevelt said, "All right, Ben. Eleanor was just in here. She had been to her doctor this morning for a physical. And so when she came in, I asked her, 'So, Eleanor, what did the doctor have to say about that big ass of yours?' And she replied, 'Franklin, he had nothing at all to say about you.'" So she laughed, he laughed, and they had a sense of humor, which, you know, John Kennedy once told his brother Bobby, "You have to have a sense of humor in politics. You can't just be serious."
Robert, we might be down to our last minute, but let me ask you quickly. Could Roosevelt have done it without his relationship with Eleanor, without his relationship with Lucy Mercer, who's often identified as somebody that he had an affair with? But there were two other women that you write about, too. Could he have done it? And could you just explain the importance of his having these women around him that he could get feedback from?
Yeah. Well, we don't know if he was, I don't know if he was capable of sexual performance, you see, but he certainly did have an affair with Lucy Mercer, who was Eleanor's social secretary and a beautiful young woman, and that was, of course, in a time before Roosevelt had polio. But then he loved being surrounded by attractive younger women who were almost worshipful toward him, and he had this relationship with his cousin who was Margaret Daisy Suckley, who was a Hyde Park resident and had been close to him ever since he had the polio, and they were really they loved each other. I don't know whether it was physical, but they certainly, and we have her diaries and the conversations she had with Franklin Roosevelt and the exchanges, and they had an intense regard for each other. And there was also this princess from Norway who was an attractive and flirtatious woman, and he loved having them around. And Eleanor was a very serious and demanding person, and you know, there's lots of evidence in the conversations they had about how strained he would feel when she would be coming in and demanding that he do this and he do that, and not that he differed so much with her progressive views, but that he saw it as politically impossible to do a lot of what she wanted him to do. And so, but he valued having someone like his cousin Daisy, who was so worshipful and accommodating, you see, and Lucy Mercer, and so he was a complicated man, but and also a man with you know, understandable feelings.
Well, Robert Dalek, I wish we had more time. There's so much that we didn't cover, but if people want to find out how a politician like Franklin Roosevelt was able to accomplish so much in his three-plus terms in the presidency, this is the book, Franklin Roosevelt, A Political Life, written by our guest, Robert Dalek. Robert, thank you so much for spending all this time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, that was one of the country's most prominent historians, Robert Dalek. He's written a new book called Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life, and I spoke with him earlier today. We can open up the phone lines for just a moment. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Big news in the elections yesterday. A Democrat was reelected in St. Petersburg, and some Democrats are taking a lot of they're celebrating today. Probably that celebration may still be going on. But let's take a few phone calls. Jeff Haynes is our phone producer today. And let's go to Jono, who's in Sarasota. Hi, Jono. You're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
Rob, I just wanted to comment on John Muir and Peter Key. As your guest mentioned, Muir had an industrial accident. He was a very religious man. He made a deal with God that if God would restore his sight, he would devote the rest of his life to the works of the Lord. And so that set him on that journey that brought him to Cedar Key. And then in that fever that he had while he was sick in Cedar Key, he wrote some of the most persuasive environmental wording that had been written up to the time. And it really formed the sort of the precursor for our concern for endangered species. And one of, I'll just read you a couple of sentences. He said, "And what creature of all that the Lord has taken the pains to make is not essential to the completeness of that unit, the cosmos? The universe would be incomplete without man, but it would also be incomplete without the smallest transmicroscopic creature that dwells beyond our conceitful eyes and knowledge." So he was laying out a philosophy that everything, all living life was important, and it wasn't simply put here on Earth for man's enjoyment. And that was a pretty radical position at the time, and that happened in Cedar Key, and it's some of the most important environmental writing that we have in our history.
Well, I'm glad you pointed that out. Thank you so much for doing that. And where can people, Jonah, where can people read those writings that he wrote in Cedar Key?
His book, The 1,000-Mile Walk to the Gulf, is fascinating reading. Some of it would be viewed today as racist, but a lot of the material that was written at the time of the Civil War, immediately after, would probably be viewed as racist. But it's a fascinating account of his travels through Florida and his musings about the relationship between God, man, and the environment.
All right, Jonah, thanks a lot. Thanks for letting us know.
Quite welcome.
All right. That's good to know. Well, thanks a lot for listening. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment about the show on extension 115. We'll play those comments back tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Now stay tuned for NOLA. He's coming up with the Midpoint program. I'm Rob Lori. This is WMNF Tampa. Stay tuned for the news.
I'll take a drink of brandy and let myself be handy. Good old old times are coming back again. We can laugh and tell a joke. We can dance, drink and smoke. We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. Back again, back again. We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. Since Roosevelt's been reelected, yeah, we'll not be neglected. We got legal wine, whiskey, beer and gin. I'm glad to say the donkeys won election day. No more standing in the blowing rain and snow. He's got things in full sway. We're all working and getting our pay. We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. Back again, back again. We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. Roosevelt's been reelected, moonshine liquor's been corrected. We got legal wine, whiskey, beer, and gin.
This is WMNF Tampa.